Charm of Favor, Chapter 29.
Captain Jameson, I have a comm signal, said the flight engineer. Can you put it on my headset? Asked Blaine. No, sir. It is short. I make it to be only about 100 characters long. It's on the 2-meter band, sir, said the engineer. That's the old Foxtrot system. Print it out. There's a blue notebook in the file drawer by your knee. You can decode it from that table, said Blaine. That's kind of primitive, you know, said the engineer. Sometimes the old systems are the most reliable. Besides, when the Iranians grabbed a super stealthy RQ-170 out of the sky and landed it, we knew we had been digitally compromised. Radio isn't digital. You gotta have a decoder ring, my boy, said Blaine. He was close to 70 years old, and he hadn't had a flight physical in years. But he still jogged 2 miles, on the nice days, on the beach near his home. I got it, sir. They want us to land, sir, said the engineer. When? Asked Blaine. Now, sir, said the engineer. Any other instruction with that comm? Asked Blaine. Approach from the sea, 92 left, Captain, said the engineer. Number one, put on the cabin comm, said Blaine. You're alive, sir, said the co-pilot. This is Captain Jameson speaking. There's been a slight change in plans. We're going to land in Greenland. It's a balmy 18 degrees with winds of 20 knots, but I hear the chow is pretty good. I need everyone in their seatbelts except the flight deck spouses. Please make your way to the flight deck. Make sure you stow any loose items securely. Put your seat any way you like. Tray tables, blah, 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 said Blaine, motioning for the co-pilot to end the cabin connection. Within a couple of minutes, the three wives entered the cockpit and took seats beside the engineer. The engineer closed the door and took his seat again. Ladies, there's a reason I asked you up here. I believe we have been spotted and targeted. I don't see anything on radar, and my satellite feeds don't see anything either. That doesn't mean much with these guys. This ship makes a big target, even at 45,000 feet. We'll be approaching Greenland from the sea, and I have a feeling we're being used to draw their fire, said Blaine. What if we get shot down? Isn't there another way? I have grandkids, said the co-pilot's wife over the noise of the wind against the aluminum bulkhead. I don't like the idea any more than you do. Unlike the equipment I've been flying for half my life, this ship has cutting-edge countermeasures. I got flares, chaff, I even have percussion bombs. Plus, I have about 20% more throttle on this hot rod. We're not going down without a fight, said Blaine. Captain, I have some more Foxtrot code. Hold on, said the engineer as he flipped through the code tables. We knew this trip might be a one-way ticket. We were chosen for a reason, and I'm going to do my damnedest to make sure we add value to this mission, said Blaine. I got it, Captain. It says sublaunch, heat-seeking clusters, man pads, said the engineer. Man pads? Those are shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles. Those bastards! They're shooting a lunchbox up to our altitude and then triggering those from the nose cone, said Blaine. Those 9-foot turbofans out there will make an easy target for those things. I saw one take out an A-10 Warthog once doing 400 knots. It took 3 seconds to reach him from the ground, said the co-pilot. I don't think there's enough power in those things to take this jet down, but they will trash a motor in a heartbeat. 4 motors, 4 direct hits. That's pretty good odds, I'd say, said Blaine. It's just aluminum, sir. There's no armor out there, and besides, we have 140 tons of fuel in those wings, said the engineer. Radio the base, number one. Tell them we're beginning our descent, said Blaine. Captain, whoever is out there will monitor that transmission, said the engineer. I would if I were them, said Blaine, placing his hands on the 4 throttle levers. Reduce power to 50%, said the co-pilot, reading the checklist fastened to his left thigh. 50% it is, said Blaine, The plane felt like someone had stepped on the brakes as the sub-zero air dragged the jet to a slower airspeed. "I have 450 knots," said the co-pilot. 450. Coming around to 180. What's next?" asked Blaine. "At 25,000 feet, turn to 110, said the co-pilot. "Get your hands on those countermeasures. Switch on the belly cam and look for white water and smoke when we clear the coast. Ladies, you can watch that screen as well. Four sets of eyes are better than one," said Blaine. "Damn, did they have to put the landing strip so close to the water?" said the co-pilot. "Well, the good news is that that water doesn't get deep enough for a sub for about 5 miles. See those icebergs?" "That's not going to make it easy either," said Blaine. "No disrespect, sir, but they will have to be shallow to launch. Besides, if we can't see them, it's doubtful they can see us," said the co-pilot. "We'll be 40 miles from our last transmission in about 4 more minutes. When do I make that turn?" asked Blaine. 30 seconds, sir. You're still a little high. I can back off the throttle a little," said the co-pilot. "Leave it. We're not landing at Miami. That's a 15,000-foot strip down there. I can go in a little hot," said Blaine. "I don't blame you. Okay, left to 110. Your next turn will be to 60 at 12,500, said the co-pilot. "Nope, that's not going to work for me. I'm going straight north from there and punching it," said Blaine. "I can't help you, sir, if you go off procedure," said the co-pilot. "Just keep me posted on the strain gauge and the engine temperatures," said Blaine. "We're at 310 knots at 20,000 feet. It's going to be hard to reduce speed with the nose down like this," said the co-pilot. "I'm turning north to zero," said Blaine. "Sir, that will cut our approach by at least 30%, and you're more than a mile too high," said the co-pilot. "Hold on. We're doing a 60-degree turn, just like in the simulator," said Blaine. The right wing came up to nearly vertical. Passenger flights never got even close to 3 G's in a commercial flight. The average person will pass out at this strain, but pilots are trained to 3.5 G's, and military pilots experience 6 G's in a centrifuge to know what it feels like. You're trained to breathe, tighten the core muscles to keep blood in the brain, and in extreme applications, pilots wear a compression suit to squeeze the blood out of the legs to make it easier for the heart to keep the pilot conscious. "Strain gauges are near the limits, sir," said the co-pilot. "You ever do a barrel roll in one of these?" asked Blaine. "You can't be serious," said the co-pilot. "No, not really. You don't have to worry about dropping a serving cart on the ceiling in the simulator. But believe it or not, this baby will do it," said Blaine, sinking into the seat with the high banking turn to the north. 5, 4. "Okay, you're at zero, sir," said the co-pilot. The big jet leveled out the wings, and the captain reached forward for the throttle levers and pushed them to the firewall. "Approaching 400 knots, said the co-pilot. "I don't want to be over this deep water any longer than I have to be. Hold it at 400 knots. "How far until we line up with 272? Asked Blaine. "Calculating. 2 minutes, sir," said the co-pilot. "A whole lot can happen in 2 minutes, said Blaine, smiling over at his co-pilot. They were both shaking in their seats as the jet stream was approaching the aircraft from the west over the left wing. The enormous tail felt like it was kicking its way through the thick Arctic air. "Even eggs take 3 minutes," said the co-pilot, smiling back. "Shit! Captain, I have a launch. Yes, yes, I have a launch at 3 o'clock, sir," said the engineer. The wives gripped their hands together and began to cry. A pilot's wife has a secret place in her heart for plane crashes. It's a place of resolve with a respectful flag folded in the study and a visit once a month to the cemetery. There was a peace that came from knowing a man died doing what he loved doing, and believing that he faced the end with dignity and no regrets. "Launching countermeasures," said the engineer. "Belay that, man. That's just the missile with no guidance. When the nose cone opens, those missiles have to light up and acquire our heat signature. When you see those candles, then drop the flares," said Blaine. Turn left to 272 in 30 seconds, said the co-pilot. The captain reached for the throttles and pulled them back all the way. The plane lurched backward, straining their chests against their seat belts. Turn the radar off when that missile reaches 12,000 feet, said Blaine. Aye, Captain. 10 seconds, said the engineer. Kill the engines, said Blaine. Kill the engines? Asked the co-pilots in disbelief. Do it now. Radar 2, I want this ship cold. Everything except the APU, said Blaine. Aye, Captain. Engines off. You have to turn now to 272, sir, said the co-pilot. Holy shit, Captain. It blew up, said the engineer. No, it didn't. That's the nose cone blowing open. Watch for those candles, and then get the first wave of flares deployed, said Blaine as he banked the silent jet hard to the left and pushed the nose down. I can't see anything through the smoke from the nose cone charges going off, Captain, said the engineer. You have maybe 10 seconds for those man pads to light up. They have to stabilize first. What's our engine temperatures? Asked Blaine. Number 4 is still about 300, but it won't stay there long at minus 70 degrees, said the co-pilot. Okay, help me with this. Left rudder down, left ailerons down. Let it go to 75 degrees, and then let the wing drop slowly. Watch those strain gauges, said Blaine. You've done this before? Asked the co-pilot. In a Cessna. Same principle. Trust me, the wings will stay on, said Blaine, sounding like he was lifting 200 pounds of dead weight. Airspeed dropping, said the co-pilot, also straining his voice with the effort. So's our altitude. That's the point. Less rudder. Watch the heading. Flying sideways is a little like drifting a Mustang. Just don't wuss out on me, said Blaine. You've drifted a Mustang? Asked the co-pilot. Yes, he has. Just ask our grandson, said Linda, gripping the armrests on her seat. A little different looking out the side window, isn't it? Asked Blaine, fighting with the yoke that was shaking in his hands. Flares away, flares away, said the engineer as he pressed the blue button on the panel. Coming up on 10,000. We're going to be long, sir. I'm getting a stall alarm, said the co-pilot. That's just because we're slipping this ship sideways like a trainer. Push the nose down further. Bring that tail around harder, said Blaine. Sir, we're red on the tail side load, said the co-pilot, raising his voice. It'll hold. Bring it around. Focus on those numbers down there. We have a dozen rockets looking for our ass right now, said Blaine. Oh my God, there's an explosion, said the engineer. Fire the second flare battery. Number 2, said Blaine, trying to sound like he wasn't panicking. Number 2 away. Oh yeah, there's another explosion, said the engineer. How many left? Asked Blaine. There's the sub, right over there on the screen. I think it's surfaced, said Linda, pointing. Suddenly the yoke shuddered in their hands, and there was a loud explosion. 2 rockets flashed past the cockpit, leaving white trails of smoke. Number 3 is hit. We have a fire, said the co-pilot. The auto extinguisher will get it. If they hit number 4, we'd be down. The inboard engine is bolted to the top frame spar. We're okay, said Blaine. Do you think they'll shoot again? How far do we have to go? Oh my God, what was that? Asked Linda, pointing at the screen displaying the belly camera. Did we do that? Asked the engineer. Talk to me, people. I'm a little busy right now, said Blaine. Damn, what a shockwave. That sub is gone, said the engineer. What? Who did it? Any ships down there? Did they have a malfunction? Asked Blaine. Maybe another sub. Looks like it came out of the sky, said the engineer. We need to drop another 5,000 before we line up, said Blaine. Airspeed's still over 250. Fire is out, said the co-pilot. Bring that tail back. Give me some flaps. Let's see if we can use the landing gear to slow us down a little, said Blaine. Should I restart the engines? Asked the co-pilot. Better not. We might not be able to use number 4. That would be a bit of a trick. Besides, it's not like there's much more than a chain-link fence to run into down there, said Blaine. There's no going around, said the co-pilot. Okay, no negativity on my flight deck. Line us up. 20% flaps. Gear down, said Blaine, grabbing the lever and pulling it up. The cockpit of a Boeing 747 is quiet when the airspeed gets below 200 knots. Without any engines running, it feels more like a simulator than an aircraft weighing 375,000 pounds, not including fuel. No one had ever stalled an actual 747, and Captain Blaine Jameson didn't want to be the first. Gear is down, and it looks like we have hydraulic pressure, said the co-pilot. Well, will little wonders ever cease? Let's get this baby on the ground, said Blaine. The blue and white 747 touched down on the frozen landing strip and lumbered to a stop, using only the brakes. There was runway to spare, and the three men and their wives unfastened their seatbelts and hugged in the cockpit. That was a pretty quick war, said the engineer. They'll probably just mark it up to equipment malfunction, said Blaine. That was a hell of a ride, Captain. It was a pleasure flying with you, said the co-pilot, shaking his hand firmly. The Greenland jet is on the ground, less one engine, Agent Larson, said Rocky. And the Nork sub? Asked Mr. Larson. The X-37B dropped a rod down their hatch. It's nice when things work the first time. A 6-inch diameter tungsten dart about 8 feet long with steerable fins delivers a hell of a kinetic punch at Mach 8, said Rocky. I thought they were bigger than that, said Mr. Larson. The first few deployments carried larger ones, and even anti-satellite weapons, but we opted for the milder sonic boom and higher weapon count. We could have taken that sub out at periscope depth, but when it surfaced, it made the target imaging system more reliable, said Rocky. The infamous rod of God, said Mr. Larson. More like a stick, but it gets the job done, said Rocky. Where's the other Air Force One? Asked Mr. Larson. 45,000 feet over the Gulf of Mexico, said Rocky. I'm sure they know about this attack by now, said Mr. Larson. The chances of them having subs in the Gulf are slim, but possible. They only have 20 Romeo-class Russian 1,800-ton subs painted green, but they are easy to detect. They use them to move their missiles around the peninsula, but it's doubtful any of those snuck into the Gulf. Not that it would be that difficult if they went slow on electric power, zigzagging through 27,000 oil rigs out there. But they have developed a 2,000-ton Sinpo-class sub that is very quiet and sophisticated. It only has one launch tube, and we're pretty sure that it's not an operational capability, said Rocky. So it's a little like a single-shot cannon. Fire, reload, and fire again, said Mr. Larson. You know it's not that easy. Missiles don't launch from inside the sub. They're ejected with gas like oxygen or nitrogen up through the surface. The fins pop out, the rocket lights up. It takes a trained crew and lots of practice, said Rocky. Not if you steal the drawings and procedures from Daewoo Shipbuilding and program the system to do it automatically. You actually believe that crap published by some defense analyst from Colorado who looks at pictures all day? Besides, my intel indicates the Norks aren't trying to start a war. They're trying to end one they have been led to believe was started by the United States 55 years ago. My guess is they're being fueled and financed by groups that need little Kim to play the part of the unstoppable maniac, said Mr. Larson. I should have sent that guy a package a year ago, said Rocky. That's not who we are, Rocky, said Mr. Larson. You know what? Your rules have just about put the lives of 2 million people at risk in Nashville right now. Little Kim, as you call him, is playing the part too well. It's time to end him and his game, said Rocky. You know as well as I do that he is placed there, in the news, every day, to smudge the fingerprints of this globalist syndicate, said Mr. Larson, putting his hand on Rocky's shoulder. Don't punch out of your weight class, Tommy, said Rocky, pulling his shoulder away and turning for the door. You know I wouldn't do that to you, Rocky, said Mr. Larson calmly, as Rocky shot him a burning glance before walking out his office door. "Does anybody know where the hell Jack is?" asked Rocky, loud enough to be heard across all the cubicles. "I saw her leave 15 minutes ago. She's headed to General Banks' office," said James. "And you let her go?" "Jesus, Jimmy, she's just a kid," said Rocky. "You think I don't know that? Besides, have any of us ever been able to tell her not to do something?" asked James. "Just because she's taller than me doesn't mean she can't be told what to do," said Rocky. "That was before you went away to Annapolis. She and Dad got really close. She changed her name, remember? What 16-year-old changes her name? I have a feeling there's something she's supposed to do that we just can't do," said James calmly. "I guess I should be glad she's not out chasing boys. I'd probably be in jail by now," said Rocky. "I kind of pity the boy who does catch up with her," said James, smiling and punching Rocky in the shoulder playfully. "You'd be late, as usual. But I'd figure out a way to blame it on you," said Rocky, smiling, then hugging his brother around the shoulders. "Let's live long enough to find out, okay? Let's get this guy," said James. "Yeah, well, see, there's the issue, isn't it? There are thousands of him, and there are hundreds above him, and dozens above them. We don't even know if there is a leader to this effort to destroy America. History shows their old dried-out carcasses being buried on rainy days without much fanfare. But it is as though they never left. These wealthy, powerful psychopaths who change the course of history are seamlessly replaced by other psychopaths, and the script just keeps running. It's like there's some other, much older evil who's really running things by using the greed and lust of a very few people to accomplish the mission," said Rocky. "Now you're sounding like Mr. Larson," said James. "Let's not talk about Agent Larson, Jimmy," said Rocky, pointing his finger at James's chest. "I like him. Jack likes him," said James, not backing away from his brother. "In case you haven't noticed, we do things by the book around here. We do that for a reason. So if one of us goes down, the next in command can take over the mission without getting everybody killed," said Rocky. "What? Is he some kind of free agent or something?" asked James. "He uses his feelings, so he says. He is smart, articulate, and inhumanly deadly," said Rocky, looking at the floor for a moment. "And he doesn't go by the book?" asked James, trying to finish the thought. "I think he wrote the damn book," said Rocky. "Okay. I just got a weird kind of chill going down my spine. He looks like he's maybe a 38-year-old brick shithouse. Jack says he's a football coach who teaches history," said James. "He says you can't put the future into words. He says every time it has been tried, humans read it and choose something else. Yeah, you can look upstream. Everybody does that. He has a way of looking back from there to where we're standing now. Damnedest thing I ever saw. But he has saved the world more than once," said Rocky. "Why the hell does he teach high school history and coach a local football team?" asked James. "I used to think he was recruiting. But I remember Dad telling me about a man, a special agent who... I swear he was describing Larson, but it just ain't possible, Jimmy. Larson would have to be like 9 years old. And when I told him I was going to Annapolis, he cried. He cried, man. He said he knew, had known, for a long time. Told me I was going to be a spook," said Rocky. "Hey, I love you, Rock. You're the best man I have ever known. You're so good, it doesn't surprise me that some intelligence out there in the universe, or even another dimension, hasn't seen it too. Let's save the world. If that's what we're going to do today, make peace with Larson, and let's both thank God he's on our side," said James. "By the way, I just wanted you to know it wasn't my decision. I made the suggestion, but I didn't make the choice," said Rocky. "To do what?" asked James. To put you on the president's team. That was Sophia. She had a choice of virtually anyone to make up that team, and she chose you. Don't ever sell yourself short. I never have, said Rocky. I've had no trouble selling asphalt and rebar. Selling James is another story, said James, patting his chest with his right hand. We would have never made it without you, helping Mom and us. Don't be afraid to love, that's all I'm saying, said Rocky, pointing through James at the door behind him. Hey, Rousseau's, Lanny sent me to get you, said Hannah from the door. James turned around to face Hannah while Rocky smiled like they'd been discussing what's for dinner. Sounds dated, I know, but you had me at hey, said James, walking toward her, wrapping his arms around her and kissing her neck. I'd say get a room, but you probably both need showers. Besides, you have a world to save. Let's go, said Rocky. You're an asshole, Rocky, said James, laughing. Tell me something I don't know. Come on, said Rocky, moving past them and out into the cubicle complex. Well, Tommy said you could take a punch, but Jesus, girl, looks like you took a size 10. You okay to run a few times for me? We have some drone pictures coming in a few minutes of this pickup truck on I-65. This is leak bait, so it has to be run by hand. Buys us a few minutes on these bastards, said the general. It's okay. I just have to use this hand. I'll just sit until it comes through, said Jack. I take full responsibility for what happened, said the general after a brief silence. I guess I thought I was indestructible. I was lucky, and I know it. But I learned something. School of hard knocks, you know, said Jack, trying to wiggle her two taped fingers in the splints. I should have sent Meade with you, said the general. No offense, but I couldn't live with the idea of escaping while someone else takes the ass whipping, which means we probably would both be killed, said Jack. Well, the silver lining is that they had to show their hand. We rounded them all up, and they are at a new location, said the general, placing her right fist into her left palm. What makes an American turn into one of those animals, asked Jack. Mostly, they're ordinary people who live in a world that tends to leave them behind. They want to be rich, powerful, famous, but they know no amount of effort on their part will ever make it happen. They get desperate in their lust. That's when this syndicate moves in. I would never have believed it if I didn't see it for myself, said the general. Are we talking about that magic stuff again? Asked Jack. Magic? Asked the general. Mr. Knorr talks about what sounds to me like magical powers. I don't know. It sounded a little too much like a comic book to me, said Jack. I found bad guys since I was out of high school. One of these stars is just for being a woman who could shoot straight and take orders. The other two, I earned the hard way. The past 10 years, every time we take a city back, we find the same stuff. Someone or something is out there, buying up men's souls. These people are no longer human, said the general. Who teaches that crap? Asked Jack. You don't have to be smart. You don't even have to be able to read, because someone will recite the words for you. Once you make the oath and go through the ritual, you belong to them. Raymond says God will never know them again. That is a terrible place to be, Jack, said the general. Don't they see that? I mean, don't they have dreams for themselves? Asked Jack. They're taught to live in the now, whatever the hell that means. There is no tomorrow, unless their demon god gives it to them, said the general. What's the name of this god? Asked Jack. Now you're getting into Tommy's backyard. I don't know. I should, but I don't. I've seen so many names, but the oath and the rituals are all the same. It's the same guy behind all of the religions, if you ask me, said the general. There's got to be one that's true, right? Asked Jack. If there was, it was infiltrated a long time ago and corrupted out of existence. Even Jesus only lasted, what, 3 years? Said the general. It's probably why there are so many. People just keep running to the next church, looking for answers to the secret to life, said Jack. I'm no scriptorian, but I think that's a psyop. There is no real secret. This evil camouflages life behind money. Then it makes people fight over it, like there isn't enough for everybody. But then, there's the joy of killing. That look they get when they take a life. That's the part I don't understand, said the general. You mean they like it? Asked Jack. Better than sex, Jack. In fact, even their sex has to be violent. A religion of peace? Give me a damn break. It's a cult of rape. Rape of the body, rape of the soul. We've been fighting it in this country for more than 375 years. And Tommy says it is much older than that, said the general. Kind of makes you want to believe in superheroes, said Jack, her mind wandering into the impossibility of this timeless struggle for peace. This is the costume of a superhero, Jack, said the general, patting the rows of medals on her left breast pocket. Not everyone who wears it is one, but I've witnessed the most incredible acts of courage and strength you can imagine inside a uniform just like this one. My brother Mike calls you guys Wars R Us, always looking for a fight and bombing the shit out of someone because you can, said Jack, feeling a little like she was watching a recruiting speech. That's what happens when politics gets mixed with the gunpowder, said the general. Mr. Larson said, when the spooks are used by one party against the other party, the Constitution gets put in the shredder, said Jack. Jack, if I've learned anything from history, it is that peace comes through strength. Bad men are successful when good men do nothing, said the general. The cycle. It's the four phases of society. War, peace, mercy, justice. That's what my dad used to say, said Jack. I've heard that before. It seems someone would have figured out a way to cut the chain at the right place by now, said the general. Oh, they have. But it matters where you cut it. Mr. Larson says the globalists want to cut off the mercy. That way there's only justice, and you never get to the war phase, said Jack. Sounds like slavery to me, said the general. I go crazy thinking about it sometimes. It seems endless, said Jack. It's not the cycle. It's what you put into it that makes it so crazy, said the general. Is that your message? I heard something, said Jack, pointing to the screen on the general's desk. I'm printing it now. Take this package to Knorr. He'll send you to Rocky. Bring me the package Rocky gives you. Hustle up, Jack. You're doing great, said the general, zipping the document holder shut and handing it to Jack. She brought her feet together and snapped a salute to Jack. Jack choked off the tears welling up in her eyes. She brought her black sneakers together and returned the first salute of her life back to the general. I won't let you down, General, said Jack as she turned and ran out the door, wiping the tear from her black and blue cheek. Come in, Jack, floated the deep and calm voice as Jack entered the small office alcove of Raymond Knorr. Her fingers throbbed against the tape holding them to the shaped aluminum. She could see a little better, but her face was thick and unable to feel her long hair. She fed it behind her ear with her thumb and walked into Knorr's office. I have some images from General Banks, sir, said Jack, standing before him, holding the zippered portfolio in front of her. Now I see your father coming through, said Knorr, standing and gently accepting the portfolio from her. Jack collapsed in the soft chair in front of his desk and took a deep breath. It shuddered out of her slowly. You don't know how good that sounds, said Jack softly. He took the pictures out of the portfolio and looked closely at them. He pulled a magnifying loupe from his desk and looked even closer at one in particular. "Major Meade, would you come in here, please?" asked Knorr. "Yes, sir," said Major Meade as he entered the room in parade rest and stood behind Jack. She looked up at him, to her right, feeling like she had to tilt her head back to see past the swelling above her eye. He glanced down at her, but his face did not change expression in the slightest. "I am glad to see you are so in tune, Major. You showed up at exactly the right moment," said Knorr. "Jack, I am so sorry. I should have been here to go with you," said the Major. "If you had, we would both be dead. I wouldn't run without you, and you know it," said Jack, barely able to speak. Something in the room was building energy. She could feel it, but she did not recognize it. Her skin began to flush, and she felt like she would get sick for a moment. "Jack, what would you like to see happen right now?" asked Knorr. "What? I don't know," said Jack, almost whispering against the roar in her head. "Yes, you do. But you need to say it. Say it now, Jack," said Knorr very softly, very smoothly, as he stood without taking his eyes from hers. I want to live. I want to get rid of this pain and feeling hurt. I'm needed, and I feel like everyone is depending on me. And I don't want to quit," said Jack, the words coming in short breaths and curled lips. "That's what I needed to hear." Raymond Knorr moved around behind where she was seated and pulled her hair back over her shoulders and the back of the chair. "We don't have much time, and I needed the Major as a witness. These sorts of things always need a witness," said Knorr. "What do you want me to do?" asked Meade. "I'll take you with me. It's time you saw this as well. Place your right hand on top of mine and keep your balance," said Knorr as he placed his two enormous white hands softly on Jack's head, and she closed her eyes. The Major placed his right hand on top of Knorr's as he began to speak. "Jack Rousseau, in the course of time, untime, we often lose our way. Memories and treasures are often shared between souls, stored sometimes for eons, for a special time. This is one of those times, and we are three of those souls. Open your heart and your mind to receive that which you placed with us long ago." His words were smooth, unrehearsed or scripted, but flowed into her like they had been chiseled into stone thousands of years ago on a distant world. She could see a bright white light behind her eyelids, but she dared not open them. It started in her core and began to spin faster and faster until it expanded past her ribs and into the room around them. She felt it swallow them, all in a ball of energy. She could smell the smoke of wood burning and hear the crashing of waves on the shores. She could hear Raymond speaking, but the words were far away and more like a waterfall than a voice. As soon as it began, the light slowly died out, and she felt the weight of their hands lifted from her head. "Open your eyes, Jack. I have a message for you," said Knorr. She opened her eyes. They were clear and wide. She lifted her hand to her cheek and felt the smooth, perfect skin she had since she was a small child. The swelling was gone. Her pain was gone. It felt like an hour had passed, maybe days. "What is it?" asked Jack. "The message is Pinnacle Javelin. Take it to Rocky and no one else," said Knorr. "But the general, she..." began Jack. "She will be there when you get there," said Knorr. "How do I thank you? What do you call that?" asked Jack, standing up. "Let's just call it a download. Now, you go save the world, Jack. Major, this time, You go with her, said Knorr. Yes, sir, said the major, bringing his heels together. He turned on the balls of his feet and walked out the door with Jack.